Okay, so just a couple of housekeeping things. This is week 6 of the series on the book about anxiety. We're going to go one more week on this topic. And then for the rest of the term, we'll do some one-off topics, which I'll talk about next week, hopefully. And that'll take us to the end of the term. So, just let's do a review from last week, first of all. So, last week's chapter was on another sort of level focusing on relationships, where we talked about the recognition that everyone has flaws, and sometimes it's not just differences, but it's actually imperfections. And dealing with that sometimes is problematic because it comes from a lack of awareness of this concept that relationships actually require work, right? So we talked about that when we have anxiety, we have to get out of control. We have to use our awareness to own our imperfections and others, and not to understand it. And use what we call the misfire of low-level anxiety as a reminder that we need to shift and we need to do some work. So we talked about two spirals, the disconnection spiral, the connection spiral. They both start off the same. So the disconnection spiral starts off with a trigger, something bothers me, something I'm annoyed with something. And then we get to anger and catastrophizing, like you always, every time, you never, all that kind of stuff, which results in a cycle of blaming, sometimes shame, blaming even ourselves or the other person, and it just full spirals out into a broken relationship. Whereas the connection spiral starts off the same way. We're triggered by something that we're annoyed with. We accept that people are limited. We try to have compassion on the other people and ourselves, and then we reduce the disconnection. Okay, so that's the essence of what we talked about last week. This week, which is the next chapter of the book, is also still continues on the relationship, and that sort of ends that discussion. And it takes what we discussed so far on anxiety and relationships to a whole new level. I was actually in 2 minds whether I should do the chapter because it's more about relationships than it is about anxiety. But it's really good, and it offers some interesting perspectives that we haven't sort of touched upon in our other discussions on relationships. So we'll do it. It's a good discussion anyways. So he continues and he says the following. He says that once we accept that all relationships are not perfect, right? So that's a big step, and we've done that. We've talked about how, you know, having anxiety and dealing with it and can use strategies, it's easier to recognize patterns and easier to not catastrophize and so on. But it only takes us this far. He says we need to go a step further. And this is the point of what we're going to talk about. He says, if we wish to truly connect with others, we need to go a step further, listen to this, by recognizing, accepting, and expressing that we are inherently vulnerable and needy when it comes to our closest relationships, okay. Both personal and professional. We all need others, and we all need to be needed. Now, this is not easy to acknowledge, but when we do, we can transcend to levels of emotional closeness and connection that would otherwise be unattainable. Okay, so that's the point. We're going to have to unpack this. I want to mention again, as I mentioned last week, of course, that when we talk about relationships, obviously relationships are a two-way stream, a two-way thing, and therefore it requires both people to put in the work. Sometimes this doesn't happen, even though often when we put in work, we do get a response, but not always, depending on the personality and the awareness and the willingness of the other. So not everything works. Not everything we're going to talk about always works, but it's a good try anyways. Now, this idea that we're needy and we depend on others is not in line with current cultures, current timing, because there's a huge, and he talks about it as well, which we'll soon get to, there's a huge wave of this concept today, a huge emphasis on fighting for independence, for being independent, being an individual, right? Which has some good things to it. But you don't hear a lot about this concept of interdependence, which we'll talk about. Now, before we go back into the chapter and develop it, I want to just spend a few minutes talking about this from a Jewish perspective. So in Jewish thinking and in Jewish literature, this concept is so true on many, many levels, right? First of all, something we've talked about many times, that no one is created with everything. No one is created perfect by design. God created us imperfect. Part of the reason, and both internally and externally, both in terms of our internal resources, both in terms of our external resources. And one of the reasons for that, as it's discussed in the Talmud, is because God wanted a world of giving and receiving. We call, in Hebrew, mashpia and mekabel, right? On all levels. This comes from, I've talked about this before, this comes from a story in the Talmud where there was a great heretic who approached one of the great Talmudic scholars and he says, you know, I don't understand your God if he's so perfect and he has everything and he's so infinite. So why are some people needy? He was talking about, in a financial sense, he was talking about the concept of tzedakah. So the rabbi answered, he said, that's exactly the reason, because there's a verse that says, Olam chesed ibaneh, that the world is built on kindness. From God's perspective, first of all, when he created the world, he made room for an other, so to speak. He wanted to give. But he created a world that will be built and developed and nurtured and evolved by the concept of giving and receiving. Giving, use the word chesed, but in order, as we've said many times, in order to give, there has to be a receiver. But it's not just financially, it's on every level. On every level, we all have things that other people don't have. We all can contribute to others. Everyone, right, has something they can do for someone, whether it's emotional support, psychological support, just moral support, ideas that maybe the other person doesn't have. Everyone thinks differently. You can have a person who's very, very clever, but maybe clever in one sense, but not as creative as other people. And, you know, our problem is we don't always recognize that, right? We don't always recognize how much we need other people, but that's, you know, that's certainly the case. And that's the power of coming together, the power of connection, the power of relationships. On a broader level, this is also the idea we talk about in Judaism, the idea of a tzibur, a congregation, a community, right? We know that a community has tremendous power. Like halachically we find this, and just emotionally, and just there's a tremendous power in coming together, in people being connected, sometimes a lot of people, sometimes small relationships. And when it's a community, when it's a group of people, we call this in Hebrew a tzibur, right? Tzibur means congregation or community, right? I'm emphasizing the word because there's a great idea behind this word. Because the power of community, or the power of coming together, is not that like-minded people come together. That's not the power of a community. I mean, it is. It's always good when people come together. There's always power. But actually, here's the interesting thing. The word, I remember learning this when I was in high school. It's a very fascinating thing. So the word tzibur in Hebrew, which is normally a reference, it's actually a halachic term. It's a reference to like a minyan or getting together with a lot of people in order to accomplish something. In Hebrew, it's spelt a certain way. It's an acronym for three things. The main letters of tzibur is tzadi, bet, and resh, which stands for tzadikim, righteous people. The bet stands for beinonim, which is like intermediary people. And the resh stands for rasha'im, which are wicked people. Isn't that amazing? A real community are not a bunch of perfect people. Not a bunch of goody-goodies, right? A real community is you have all types because every type has what to contribute, right? And there was a concept that, especially in the Talmud talks about it, so there was a concept when there was a fast day and they needed to, it was particularly in temple times, especially when there was a drought and it wouldn't rain, and they if it got out of hand, they would proclaim a fast day. And when they proclaimed the fast day, they would go into the street. They would, it was a practice we don't do today so much, but they would have these street prayers in order to beg God to deliver us. And there was this concept that the prayer will only be effective if you have all types there, including those that are spiritually very deficient, right? Hence the word Rasha'im, yeah? Because it comes together. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but every Yom Kippur we do this idea. On Yom Kippur, before Kol Nidre, everyone knows Kol Nidre, right? But you know, there's a statement that the Chazan makes before Kol Nidre, where he formally includes in the prayer the transgressors. That's what he says. Anachnu matirim. If you look at the Machzor, you'll see he says it quietly. It's supposed to say it quietly, but before the Yom Kippur formalities begin, the Chazan says, Anu matirim, we permit and we proclaim the effectiveness, so to speak, of davening with everyone, including those people that are termed transgressors, whatever that means. But this is the idea. The idea is everyone has to be together. You know, talking about Yom Kippur, or really every day in the temple, there was, particularly on Yom Kippur, there was a ritual called Ketoret, offering up incense. Right? Incense. which actually happened every day in the temple. There was a special small altar for it, where they would put incense and coals on a pan, and would put incense in, and would put it on the altar. But on Yom Kippur, which was the main day of the year, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, would go into the Holy of Holies. And what would he do in the Holy of Holies? This was the moment of Yom Kippur, the holiest place, the holiest man on the holiest day, going to the holiest place. What would be the focus there? He would also bring Ketoret, incense. The incense, I'm not going to go into it now, but the incense was a whole symbol of being very connected to God and so on and so forth. The Torah prescribes in a very, very detailed way how the Ketoret, how the incense has to happen. And the Torah lists 11 spices that had to be in the concoction of this incense, right? And by the way, the concoction created a huge, hugely beautiful aroma. The Talmud says that there were no perfume shops in Jerusalem at that time because you didn't need it. It was like, it was just the smell of the city was the whole thing, right? Now, in these 11 spices, one of them is called the chelbena. I'm not sure what it is in English, but the spice called the chelbena. And in fact, on its own, the chelbena did not generate a nice aroma. On the contrary, it has generated a very unpleasant aroma. Right? And yet it was one of the 11 spices that the Kohen Gadol had to use to go into the Holy of Holies. Right? And the law, the legal perspective of this is that if the Kohen Gadol dares go into the Holy of Holies with one of these spices missing, it was considered a terrible thing. Right? It was very, very, very bad transgression. So you had to take, everyone was, each one of these 11 spices were important, including the chelbena, which wasn't very pleasant. Because if you want to represent, if you want to come together, if you want to create the power of connection, the power of community, the power of a group, it has to include all kinds. If you exclude anyone from that group, with all their deficiencies, with all their imperfections, in other words, the point here is, and we're going to develop this a little later, is that those people with huge imperfections, maybe very blatant imperfections and obvious imperfections, are still needed. That's the power of connection, the power of relationship, that we need everyone, everyone needs us, and we need each other, right? Just on this point a little bit, I just want to bring you a couple of examples, the power of this, right? You know, everyone knows the story of Noah and the flood, right? So God destroyed the world because they were terrible. They weren't behaving very nicely. But we also know around the same time, there was another group. After the flood, there was a whole group, when population repopulated again, there was a whole group who also rebelled against God. And they built the what's known, it's a very cryptic part of the Chumash, not like the flood is very detailed, but this part is a bit cryptic and talks about people who built a tower, the Tower of Babel it was called, right? Essentially, there was heresy, it was going against God, it was like fighting against God, it was not believing in God, which is considered a very terrible thing. It's Avodah Zarah, it's like idol worship, right? Which is considered a terrible thing in Judaism. And yet, they weren't punished. They weren't killed, they weren't eliminated, they weren't destroyed. God didn't destroy them. He dispersed them. Interesting story, actually. At that time, everyone spoke one language, the Torah tells us, and he made everyone suddenly talk a different language, and they couldn't communicate, so they ended up disbanding the whole idea, right? Okay, but why weren't they punished like the people in the times of the flood? And we find a very interesting reason, a very fascinating idea. The sins of the flood, the sins before the flood, was the sins of violence, aggression, theft, right? Incidentally, the word used in the story of Noah is Hamas, actually. It says the world was filled with Hamas. That's the term. Because Bradeh means robbery. It means, you know. In other words, they were completely a divided people. When you're completely a divided people, you become very vulnerable to God's wrath. And therefore, their punishment was very severe. The Tower of Babel people did terrible things. They went heresy, I mean, on the highest level. But they were incredibly united. And therefore, they weren't punished in that way. Because unity, even with people who aren't so good, unity is very, very powerful, right? Purim is coming up. We'll be mentioning Purim, right? And this is interesting. This concept is very much hinted in the story of Purim. When Haman decides he wants to plot against the Jews, it wasn't so simple. He had to strategize. How's he going to get Ahasuerus to agree, the king to agree, right? So if you look in the Megillah, he says to Ahasuerus something interesting because he knew that Ahasuerus is very scared of the Jewish people. Ahasuerus knew a bit of Jewish history, a little bit, and he understood that, you know, anytime people start up with the Jews, eventually it backfires on them, and, you know, God saves us, and he doesn't want to go the way of the Egyptians, and the way of the Babylonians, and etc., etc. And he tells Haman, you know, you want to start up with the people that God's on their side. I mean, it's a bit of a problem, right? So he says to Ahasuerus the following, he says, Yeshno am echad, there is a nation, mefuzar u'mefarad bein ha'amin. There are scattered people. So you can learn that, you can read that on two levels. One level is that scattered means among the kingdom of Ahasuerus. They live in different countries or different provinces. Ahasuerus was a king of 127 provinces, and they live in all your provinces. But actually the commentaries say he meant something different. He says, Mefuzar mefarad, they scattered. They are divided people. They are divided people, you have nothing to worry about. You can plot against them and they'll be fine. God's not going to come to their support when they're scattered like that, right? It's a harsh thing to say, but that's the reality of Jewish history, right? I mean, unfortunately, and again, I'm very clear always, I don't try and explain God's ways, I don't understand God's ways, I certainly don't interpret, but we just observe realities, right? Now, the power of unity is coming up amazing. Unfortunately, before October the 7th, we were a very divided people, right? Shockingly so, and caused, and you know, some people have commented that it made us weak. Did it make us spiritually weak? Could be also, I don't know, but I'm saying, I'm not explaining why God allows things to happen, but the fact that we were very, very divided. Now there's a whole different tone, right? Now we have songs of B'yachad N'Natzeach, together we're going to be victorious. There's an amazing unity, amazing togetherness, right? Which will bring blessing, obviously. But it's just so many examples of how we see in Judaism the power of needing each other, and even if the person's better than me, not better than me, higher than me, lower than me, perfect, imperfect, doesn't make a difference. It's about God created the world where we need each other. So back to individuals, smaller relationships, intense relationships, deep relationships. It's not just that we have relationships and relationships are great things. We actually need relationships. We know that the human experience is just that we need relationships. And the way relationships work and the way they deepen and the way they flourish is a recognition and an acknowledgement that I need the other person and the other person needs me. It's not just about thriving through difference. Difference is a great thing. It's much deeper than that. It's about the neediness. It's about actually I need the other person actually needs me. I have something to give the other person that they can't do themselves, and vice versa, right? And therefore his concept is, which he's going to develop, is that we need to acknowledge that, and we have to have the vulnerability sometimes to be able to recognize that and express that, right? Which is not easy, given human ego. So let's get back to his description of all of this, right? He says like this. He starts off this chapter by saying there's what he calls the paradox of relationships. He says there's an inherent paradox in human relationships. On the one hand, interpersonal connection gives us tremendous fortitude. So we become strong through relationships, right? That's how it works. People become stronger. We know that. Good relationships increase longevity, increases well-being, physical well-being, emotional well-being, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, he says, we derive most strength when we acknowledge a weakness. It's interesting. I've never seen it put that way, but it's very interesting. So that strength we receive from relationships is only there when we acknowledge a weakness, our vulnerability and resultant need for others, and when others do the same. Right? So there's interesting studies done with this about even in the workforce, that the real team of a workforce only happens and only thrives, for example, when employees understand that they need each other, right? And that they can learn from each other, and it goes both ways. And it's we find even on a corporate level and in a sort of a business level that human relationships are founded on a platform of acknowledging the need for others. And then it works, and then it's successful, right? There was a story. I'm not going to go into the whole story now. It's a long thing, but it's a story about a person who was very, very wealthy, and he got to the point where he had established a business, and he was now able to sort of stand back and employ people, the right people, and it was very good. He did all the right things. He employed people that will have the ability to run the business and be successful in the business, and he was still involved. And then he started, and the success was incredible. But then suddenly he was incredibly unhappy. And the reason was because he was no longer needed. Right? He'd done such a good job that the place was running fantastically without him, which was a great credit to him, right? But probably also meant that it was time for him to completely step aside and do something else where he is needed, because a person can't operate. So in other words, he thought he'd be able to sit down, you know, go to his office and just observe with great happiness and great sort of nachas, right, the tremendous success that he had built, and that was, he was responsible for this thing running so well. But it didn't actually work for him, because he wasn't needed, and a person needs to be needed. And when a person's not needed, there's no good relationship. And the same thing is, he says that, the same thing with romantic relationships or loving relationships, right? And he says that's the relationship paradox. He says almost nothing is more degrading than being in a romantic relationship with a partner who doesn't value the contribution you make to their life. Conversely, when romantic partners feel they need each other, it is one of the most precious experiences we can have. It may even be the pinnacle of love. So this is a very interesting point, right? Now, it actually goes to something that we've spoken about often with relationships, which is the concept of respect, that respect comes before love. Remember, we've talked about this many times. Because love is at the end of the day, love is the glue of relationships, but it's a selfish emotion. I love, right? So we've talked about this concept that sometimes love alone doesn't work because it's very selfishly directed and can be selfish love rather than selfless love. And that's why we know that in order to have a thriving relationship, the foundation of a relationship has to be respect. And I think it ties very much into this idea, because what is respect at the end of the day? Respect is that you actually value the other person, right? You value that they have something that you don't have. You value their individuality. But maybe it's more than just valuing the individuality. It's understanding that you have what to learn from their individual difference that's not you. Right? Because we know that relationships that respect has disappeared are very, very dangerous. They often just fall apart because, right, you have to find... I mean, always there are, you know, strategies to sort of regain respect. But when you don't have that respect, it's very hard to find true love. Because respect means that you actually... And I never thought about it in these terms, but I'm just taking what he's saying. But when you value the other person's individuality and individual difference to you, right? Because that's what relationships are. They are tremendous bonds, but they're also bonds between two individuals who have to retain and keep the individuality, right? We've talked about this in the way back, right? When we talked about relationships. I think I told you then this beautiful idea that in a Sefer Torah, Torah scroll, Lord to be kosher, there's a lot of laws that governs every letter, and also all the letters have to be there. It's like a community, right? They all have to be there. If one letter is missing, the whole Torah is not valid. But that shows the power of togetherness. But actually, the way it works is there's a law with mezuzah and sefer Torah that every letter must be written individually. It cannot be touching another letter. It's got to be completely surrounded, every letter by, it's called mukaf gvil. It's got to be surrounded by blank parchment. Right, you can have a mezuzah. I know we do this. You know, we check mezuzah sometimes. We open a mezuzah, or the scribe does. You've got a beautiful, beautiful mezuzah, but there's one thin line that's connecting one letter to the other. The entire mezuzah is invalid. And one of the, because each letter must be part of a whole, but must stand alone. And that's how relationships work. Also, that's how respect is. That when we value and we respect the other person's individual and individuality, right? Because we can learn from it. We can gain from it. Even though initially we don't like it, it doesn't sit with us, it doesn't sort of fit into our worldview, or doesn't gel with the way we do things. But everyone's got something you can learn from. And therefore, everyone can be respected and everyone can be valued, and valued in the way we actually need that difference. Right? Not easy to often come to the realization of this, right? And then he makes an interesting point. He says, unfortunately, the paradox of relationships is really mentioned within academic circles or the popular media, right? And he says this occurs for a revealing simple reason, because it goes against the grain of Western individualism, right? To recognize the value of our mutual interdependence on one another. Right? The world is not into this now. The world is very much into the individual. Now, I just said we have to respect the individual, but individual, the way the world talks about it now, is I'm okay on my own. That's why commitment to relationships is so low and all these things, right? Because people are very much about I am who I am. People talk about their authentic truth, right? I never understood what that means, but How do you know your truth is authentic anyway? But unless it's a transcendent truth, but right, but it's my truth, my thing, right? And accept me the way I am, all that stuff. In other words, all that tremendous push on being an individual to the point where people don't want to talk about interdependence, and therefore it's absent. This idea, he says, is actually absent, largely in academic literature, right? And he says that's really not good, because the truth is that we can accomplish a lot more with interdependence than independence. Interdependence occurs when we need other people and they need us, and much more can be accomplished then. He ends that part of the chapter, and he says, to put it simply, independence is overrated. I vote for interdependence. That's what he thinks, right? And by the way, going back to Purim, it's actually very interesting how Purim plays out after this whole thing, right? Haman claimed that we were completely divided, which means we didn't understand this concept. And he was wrong, because although it apparently was the case when he was plotting against the Jews, but the Jews fixed it pretty quickly. Right, one of the things that Esther said when she asked Mordechai before she goes to the king to intercede, and she asked him to gather the Jewish people and to fast and pray for 3 days, there's a very important line there in the Megillah. She says, "Leich kenos es kol ha-yudim." Go and gather the people. It needs to be done together. Don't just go proclaim a fast and tell everyone to pray in their homes. No, fight this claim of division. Fix the claim of division. Right, Leich kenos, go and gather the Jewish people together in one spot and have this massive togetherness and oneness of praying to God, because you all need each other, and then I can go to the king. And that's why when Purim was proclaimed as a festival, we have an interesting concept. So we read the Megillah, that's understandable, because it's a good thing to recall the story and thank God for the story, right? It's a part of thanking God, part of gratitude. We have a Purim meal, that's one of the mitzvot of Purim, to have a festive meal, that's understood. We celebrate. But then we have the two real easy mitzvot of Purim, which are very, very important. You're supposed to do every on Purim is Mishlach Manot Matanot Lavinim. We're supposed to send food gifts to each other, right? And give gifts to the poor, right? Give the gifts to those that need. And the Mishlach Manot one is an interesting thing. I mean, it's you know, I don't know if you know what goes on in communities, especially very densely populated communities. I mean, the circulation of food that just goes round and round the whole day is like crazy, right? What's the point almost? Like, you know, I'll go to a store, I'll buy myself some chocolates, like, you know. But this is the idea. The idea is, no, it's a symbolic concept. It's about the antidote of what Haman was trying to achieve, the division. That on Purim we shall know that we need to give to others and they need to receive, right? The matonot levinim, the gifts to the poor, is a two-way mitzvah. We have to give and they have to receive. And also the mishlach manot is to each other, even friends or acquaintances or people that know each other, to show that we need each other, right? So on a practical level, it means, you know, I send you, you send me, and so on. So what's the point, kind of thing? So the point is that no, because spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, what I can send you is different than what you can send me. Right? Might not work in Mishlach Manot. We might end up saying the same thing. But it symbolizes a very important point. What I send you is different than what you send me. Right? And that's the power of Purim. So, now, the only thing we have to be aware of when we say that interdependency is so important, there's a big difference between interdependency and codependency. All right, that's a very, very important point to make while we're talking about this. It is not good to become a completely needy person and to completely rely on the other person. So from that point of view, independence is a good thing, right? And when we talk about coming in a relationship and acknowledging, even with some vulnerability, the need for the other, it doesn't mean becoming completely reliant on the other. That's different. And that's not healthy in a relationship, right? I mean, there's so much literature today on codependency. Often happens in addiction cases and all kinds of things, right? Because it is important for each one, because codependency means that it's not a two-way street anymore. The one is completely dependent on the other, and that's not a relationship. A relationship is give and take on both ends, which means that I have independence, you have independence, we each have something to contribute, we have something that we bring to the table, we bring to the relationship, we have something to contribute, which means we are self-sufficient on some level, yet we need what I don't have. We need what the other has. So I just want to make that point. There's a huge difference when we talk about this acknowledgement and the importance of understanding that in a relationship we need each other, that we make that distinction between interdependency and codependency. It's very different. All right, so let's bring this together now. So he says, the point is, we are much stronger together than apart. We understand that. The way it happens is by mutually recognizing our vulnerability and need for one another. And then he says, which is the point of the book, as we'll see throughout the rest of the chapter, we can harness the power of anxiety in our relationship to bring us closer to others by recognizing and expressing our vulnerable needs. Okay. So that's the point of what he wants to explain. But before we do that, we have to go to another point a little bit and understand something very interesting. And he talks about, it's a very, very interesting chapter this. He talks about anxiety and anger. It's a bit hot in here, no? No, yes. No, that's good. Okay, I'll leave it. In our emotional responses to different things, just generally, right, is what we call primary emotions and secondary emotions. It's a very interesting idea. So, for example, sometimes something happens and we feel shame, right? Shame is normally not a good emotion. It's not a good thing to, not a good space to be in. And that shame often then evolves into guilt. It's not what I want to talk about, by the way, but right? The guilt is really not the problem. The problem is the shame, right? So it's not good dealing with the guilt. You got to deal with the shame, right? I'm just saying this. So there's, often we have an initial reaction or we have a certain emotion, and the emotion then expresses itself in what we call secondary emotions. So his theory, which I think is correct, is anxiety often turns into anger. He says that across the spectrum of anger, he says, I've found it rarely occurs without the presence of anxiety, fear, or stress. So often what happens is when we feel anxious about something, and we're not quite sure how to regulate that, how to express that, it's hard to express anxiety. So what do? You express it with fear, or you express it with anger. Often when we get angry with other people, it's because we're anxious about something, right? So his idea is that anger in a relationship, we talked last week about sometimes how things just spiral out of control because there's something that annoys us and it evolves into something bigger and we start the dance of anger and we create a whole conflict, right, by blaming and so on and so forth. His theory is it starts with anxiety. And, right, now we'll see what the anxiety is from in a second, right? And the anxiety evolves into anger. Tells a little funny story. I'll just tell you, it's a cute story. It's a post-COVID story. So he says that one day he was walking the street and it was after the mask mandates had been removed in the thing. And he was jogging. He was quite distant from most people. There wasn't any threat. And an older woman yelled at him in anger. She says, put on your mask. Like, you know. And he just acknowledged her and kept running and didn't worry about it. So the next day he decided, you know what? If there's people that worry about it, what do I care? I'll wear a mask. So he wears a mask. And to his surprise, he got yelled at again. This time by a younger woman. Enough of the masks. You don't need to wear this stupid thing anymore. Right? So they both got angry with him. They both lusted at him. They both screamed at him. He said, I concluded that the driving emotion of both people yelled at me was not anger, but anxiety. The first woman was scared. She was still scared. The COVID's still around. You know, people, right? It's like there was, I mean, maybe it's a different discussion, but like the discussion on unfounded anxiety during COVID and after COVID is just unbelievable. I mean, I've seen people in closed cars on their own wearing a mask. Someone's going to have to explain that to me. Right? You have more chance of suffocating than getting COVID. Or guy driving. I mean, I understand the guy on the motorbike. I don't understand really, but the guy on the motorbike driving with a mask, even though he's like 10 meters from every other car and every other person, maybe thinks it can travel through the air or something, which we now know is not true. But in a closed car with your windows up, no one in the car wearing a mask. Well, okay. But this woman was obviously anxious. She was anxious that it's still going to come to everyone, even though he's running and he's distant and 2 meters away and all kind of stuff. She's anxious he's going to get COVID. So she screamed at him. She's not angry. Anger is an expression of her anxiety. That's all right. Because you get hypersensitive and hyper-nervous about everything. The second woman who screamed at him also had anxiety. Her anxiety was about freedom. right? And there was this concept. I mean, it's an interesting discussion about we saw during COVID the ability to brainwash people and the ability for government to get involved in everything you do. And yeah, it's a concern. It is a concern. It can happen again. It's a big concern because there's no question. I'm not going into COVID politics now, but there's no question that along the line there were some irrational restrictions that made absolutely no sense, and it was just controlling people, and it was government interference on a very detailed micro way, right? So both people were anxious, that's all. They're anxious, I mean, what does it care like? Why do you have to scream at someone that's wearing a mask? COVID, the cop, right? I mean, you can make a funny comment, and I don't know why you're doing it, but she got angry. Why did she get angry? Because she had anxiety that this is crazy. That freedom is going to be taken away. So she expressed that anxiety in right? So, in a relationship, this is his point. He made this point last week, right? In a relationship, when we suddenly recognize and discover someone else's imperfections, we actually get anxious. Right? We actually get anxious. Why do we get anxious? A few things. First of all, we thought the other person was perfect, and we just discovered they aren't. It's a shock. You'll have to make you anxious. Scared, what's going to go from here? What else is beneath the surface? What else am I going to discover, right? I mean, it starts with like a little thing, but you know, who knows what kind of person I've just married or whatever, right? That kind of thing. And second of all, it's got to do with control. And this is a big thing in relationships, right? Control means that I control my life and I expect my life to go the way I perceived it was going to go. Right? When something happens that obviously teaches me that life isn't going to go exactly the way I thought it was going to go, and I realize it's out of my control, that's very anxiety-inducing. Right? So the person suddenly getting annoyed with someone else's limitations and perfection is really anxious. That's what it is. It's anxiety. And more often than not, the anxiety gets expressed in anger. And that trigger of anxiety triggers anger. Anger is a secondary emotion. And if not put in check right away, it spirals out of control, as we described last year. The disconnection spiral, as we talked about last week. Right? Now, what happens with anxiety? So he describes three scenarios, right? Because we have to know that there's another form of anger. It's called avoidance. Also very bad in relationships. So when people have anxiety, what is anxiety? We defined it the first week. Anxiety is a fear. That's what anxiety is. Anxiety is fear. But fear, an unfounded fear, right? It's not a bear in the room about to attack you. Or a car coming straight at you. That's a credible fear. And that's what God designed us to have anxiety when we see a real fear coming our way. And it what it does is it induces a response in the brain, which is fight or flight, right? Fight or flight. See, this is what happens in relationships. It's a very key perspective. What happens in relationships is that when anxiety happens because we suddenly discover the imperfections of the other, there's three scenarios. He said the first one is fight. In other words, both people get anxious and they fight. And then that just becomes a cycle of complete anger that we talked about last week, right? Both partners take an aggressive approach. They run into a mutual blame game, which happens after the anger, which sort of spirals out of control pretty quickly. And what happens with that is, and that's what we talked about last week, when that gets out of control, what kicks in is catastrophizing. Catastrophizing is a real problem when things spiral out of control, right? Because anxious people often, the anxiety often, even whether it's with themselves or with other people, this is his whole thesis in the beginning. When we have anxiety, the low-level anxiety we have in the beginning is not a problem. What is a problem if we don't get out of control is the catastrophizing that comes later. When we get scared of the anxiety, we are anxious about being anxious, and we start to catastrophize, this is going to happen, I'm sure this is happening, and then who knows what, right? When you don't even have the facts completely, right? So what happens is you go into fight mode. And in relationships, what happens is both people go into fight mode, and that's a pretty ugly kind of scenario. The second scenario could happen is fight flight, right? So that's also really bad. That tends to explode eventually. So the one person fights because angry. What does the other person do? Withdraws, right? Silent treatment. Doesn't want to fight, doesn't want to confront, it doesn't talk to you for 3 days.
So remember, yeah. What was the first one? I had fight, flight.
No, fight, fight.
Okay.
Both people fight.
Okay.
Both people have anxiety, both people are responding with one of the ways that we respond to anxiety, which is fight, right? And so it escalates, but then the other person withdraws, stonewalls, whatever the case is, that's a fight, flight scenario, which also isn't very good. He says the worst pattern of all is flight, flight. You see something, you're not communicating about it, you don't talk it through, you just withdraw, the other person withdraws, and both people become absent. And in fact, that's the worst. Because no one knows what the other's thinking, no one knows what's bothering anyone. There's just a complete breakdown of communication. There might not be open, there might not be open aggression or open anger, but it's actually worse in a way.
Passive aggression.
It's passive aggression, exactly, that's what it is. It's passive aggression. And both people there in that case are exercising passive aggression. And what happens is the kind of relationship dissolves because, and there are people, I mean, you know, the people who leave relationships and you ask them, you know, that's experience, we ask them why and saying like, nothing, like they don't know why actually, they just know that it wasn't a relationship anymore. Just because both people are absent, nothing happening in the relationship, so why should I stay in it, right? And sometimes I can go on for a long time. I've seen relationships where actually it's quite functional. I mean, everyone's coming home, everyone's sitting at the table, everyone's doing what they need to do, but there's actually no relationship there. And then eventually people realize, hey, this is not what I'm supposed to be in, and it breaks down, right? So, his point is that recognizing imperfection in someone else induces anxiety, the anxiety induces anger, and then you have one of the three responses to that anxiety and anger, which is either fight, flight, fight, fight, or flight, flight. His point is that we have the capacity, going back to what he started the chapter with, to do what he calls turn the anxiety into love, which I think is very difficult actually, but I guess it is possible, right? And he says, it's about acknowledging a couple of things. Firstly, he says, the reality is that we cannot control other people. But by showing our vulnerability, we can draw them close. Paradoxically, this maximizes the likelihood of their compliance with our wishes, though that is never guaranteed, right? And his point is that when you actually get annoyed or you get anxious by discovering imperfections of other people, the important part, number one is, first of all, to quell the anger. So all the regular anger control, anger management strategies are always important. The best one is, yes, to withdraw for a little bit. You know, they talk about count to 10, because we know, we've talked about this before. In Judaism, there's a lot about this, how words fuel an emotion. So therefore, if you think you're going to get angry, don't talk, let it calm down. But then he says, we do have to have a conversation. And that conversation has to center around your commitment to the relationship, and it has to include, this is what he says, it has to include an expression of vulnerability that I actually need this relationship and we need each other. It's a very deep relationship. That expression, going back to his initial thought of paradox of relationship, that initial expression of vulnerability brings people close together. It's also a very hard thing to do because people don't like to do that very often, especially when they're upset. They don't like to acknowledge their own vulnerability, right? Because there is a concept, not of course, again, that some relationships just need to come to an end. It's never correct to say that it's always better to be in a relationship than not to be in a relationship. But there is a lot said for that. The Talmud talks about that, right? It needs to be understood what that means, the context. But there is a concept where there is an idea of being, it's worse to be alone than to be in an imperfect relationship. Now, again, that can be a controversial statement. Right? No one should have to stay in relationships because you have to be in a relationship, right? That's not true. But it is true that dealing with low-level imperfections and learning to live with certain limitations and certain things that annoy you, you can become a lot stronger and it's much, much better than not having a relationship altogether. The loneliness of not having a relationship is very, very lonely and it can be very detrimental, right? But expressing that is hard when things are a little bit attacked. Right? Yeah, it's very good when people fall in love and they're very romantic, and of course, but then it's not vulnerable. Then it's just people expressing, I need you, I love you, you're my whole world, you're my whole world. So that's fantastic. It's much, much harder, right? But it's not a vulnerable thing at all then. It's just expression of love, right? People say all kinds of things, right? you're everything to me. Oh, yes, yeah, beautiful, but that's very nice and it should happen, but it's not, that's not coming from a place of vulnerability. Right? But that level of vulnerability, and you know me, I'm not always such a big fan of vulnerability, depending on how it's expressed. But in this case, it makes a lot of sense. In other words, the idea to be able to say, we're in a relationship, which means it's not just about two people getting pleasure out of each other. It's about two people needing each other. It's about two people having to, what to contribute to each other. And expressing that even when you are anxious, and in fact using your anxiety as a reminder to be able to express that vulnerability rather than getting angry, is often the first step to having a very healthy conversation and completely solving the whole issue. Right? And he says, there's three steps to that. Right? First of all, we need to acknowledge what we're anxious about. Not always we are aware. It's very important that, by the way. That's a general concept of the emotions. I'm sure you've had this experience where you feel uneasy, you feel stressed, you feel anxious, and you really don't know what it's about. Just something, but you're not sure, right? And then we get irritable, we sometimes get angry. Very important in the beginning to actually know what is bothering us. Like, I was so annoyed by that conversation. What would you annoy? I don't know. Right? Very often. I thought it was myself and other people. I don't know. Something. Go ahead. Sit down. Calm down. Work it out. Right? It's really important to know. As we say, the diagnosis of a disease is half the cure. You need to know what's bothering you, right? And when we, he says, and this is about channeling anxiety, when we get anxious, actually it's a reminder. It's like that smoke alarm we talked about previously. It's a reminder to actually think about, why am I uneasy about something? What's bothering me? So I know I'm anxious. Rather than get angry, let me sit down and work out what it's about. Right? Is it because it's hard to give up control? That could be a very big problem. Is it something I've discovered that's going to be really hard to live with? Whatever it is, but you need to work it out. What's bothering you, right? So the first step in relying on others is recognizing what makes us anxious. Second thing is we need to, I said this before, but just to revise, put it into three formal steps. Work out what's bothering you. Secondly, avoid anger, because anger is a secondary emotion and it's just going to get it out of control. So apply the anger management strategies, calm down, don't speak for a while, whatever the case is, right? And thirdly, we're ready to do this, we have to sit down with the people that we're talking to and express our vulnerability. Express how much we need them and how much they need us, and create closeness. When you create closeness, it opens the pathways for communication. It opens the pathways to have respectful communication, because we now have established that we value each other, because we're in a relationship, and a relationship means that we need each other. It means that we each bring something that the other can't give, or we actually are dependent. And we acknowledge that interdependence in a very real way. When we do that, we know we're different, we accept different, we have compassion for each other, we know we're both not perfect, and it creates an opening and a doorway for real effective communication to actually solve the issues. Does that mean it's always solvable? No. Right? It's not, because it needs the other person. Sometimes one person expressing vulnerability can ignite the vulnerability of the other. Right? That's, you know, it's like everything. One person does something in a group, the other person is more comfortable to do it. It's like we had this discussion the other day about asking questions after a lecture, right? If you open up a Q&A, often it's completely quiet. One person asks a question and there's 10 questions. Right? Because that's just the way it is, right? People find it hard. Am I going to be the only one? It's difficult for me. When you see others are doing it, it becomes much easier. So very often relationships, expressing that vulnerability of real interdependence actually makes the other person do that as well. Once you do that, you've created a bond. Once you've created a bond, you can have a respectful resolution. Doesn't always happen, of course. It still needs effort on both people. And going back to the concept that we have to be ready to acknowledge the general idea that relationships need work, but it's certainly in the ingredients for a much, much better chance of success. So, as I said, we're doing one more week in this topic. We're going to, not one more week altogether, just one week on the topic. Don't worry, we're not going away so fast. This section ends the relationship discussion. It goes to a different discussion, which we'll talk about next week. Don't forget about Purim, Sunday, 24th of March. And after next week, we'll do other topics, which I'll talk about next week. In the meantime, have a wonderful week.